Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm your host, Adam Simpson. I'm joined by Terry Robinson, and today we have broken out the lab equipment to take a detailed look at the most scientific tradition of all, the Sons of Aether. Terry and I have prepared very hard for this. We did not take a bunch of Thomas Dolby albums and play them on repeat just to get whipped up for this. At least Terry didn't. So let's get into it today. We are going to start off with a few announcements. Terry, is there anything to tell us about out there?
I guess this is going out September 18th, thereabout, which means I will hopefully have just finished running V5 at Gen Con for the last time. So if anyone in the audience was part of any of those sessions, I'd like to preemptively and after the fact apologize for that. That's all for me.
I try to be a responsible, mature adult, so of course I don't believe in the technocracy because, you know, it's just a game. But sometimes that belief is stretched. I found this website just a couple of days ago called VintageLibrary.com, and I thought, hey, this is great. It's got all this information on old pulp stories, helps you understand who wrote what and what order it was published in originally. And it has links to small independent bookstores where you can buy recently published reprints of old pulp stories. And so I thought, hey, you know, Sons of Aether, all this pulp fiction that they keep mentioning in multiple Sons of Aether books. So I thought I'd check it out. I ordered three cheap little books, went and made a sandwich, and came back, and the site was down. It's been down ever since. It's been like 5 days in a row. I don't know if that site is coming back. And the message is interesting. It says 403 forbidden. So it's like, okay, I know the technocracy is not real, but you know, if they were real, this would probably be the kind of thing that they would pull. But they're not real. So another thing is, in the past, we talked about some pulp fiction, specifically from the 1930s, because the first Sons of Aether tradition book mentioned that as a great source of inspiration for Sons of Aether stories, specifically the science fiction pulp stories from the 1930s. And so there was one I didn't mention that I think is worthy of a mention. I said in the past that I was trying to find more visual inspirations for Mage fans rather than just more textbooks to read, if they're art books or comics or things like that. And what I did not mention before is Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon is thought of by many to be an inspiration for the adventurer pulp heroes of the Sons of Aether. And Flash Gordon started as a Color Sunday comic strip in 1934. It ran for many years. And Titan Books has issued some nice hardback collection books, more than 200 pages, that collects those Sunday comics. I grabbed mine off of Amazon full retail, of course, but it was like $40. They're not out of print or rare or anything. They're really nice. I was looking through the Amazon reviews, and people were praising it for the faithful reproduction of color values, which was a problem with past reprints of Flash Gordon comics. But anyways, you can get the entire 30s run of Flash Gordon for an affordable price, and the artwork is really very nice. Here you can see the visual inspiration for the spaceships, the ray guns, the aliens and monsters, and all those other crazy things that are so often associated with pulp science fiction and the stuff that was inspired by it. So I would recommend it. This first one is called Flash Gordon on the Planet Mongo by Titan Books. Definitely worth picking it up if you'd like some pulp science fiction inspiration, especially visual inspiration for any of your Sons of Aether stories. Well, that's it for me. I think we're ready to roll into this episode now. We are talking today another episode of Tomes of Magic. This is Tradition Book Sons of Aether Revised. This one came out in 2003. Clocks in at 100 pages. Authors are Samuel Inabinet and Malcolm Shepard. My apologies if I mispronounce those. I, of course, don't know those authors personally. I think we're ready to head into it. Terry, can you give us a walkthrough?
I can, darn it. This is a weird combination of authors because when I think Sam Inabinet, I think a lot of the early 2E stuff when Satyros had started working with it. And when I think Malcolm Shepard, I think the Akashiyana and the Euthanatoi and books that are so big that they have to change the font size to get it all to fit. fit. This did include a few font size changes, which I found utterly infuriating, but this clocks in at a mere 66,000 words, which is about on par with the rest of the non-Malcolm Shepard ones. So I don't know, maybe he had busy time and was only able to make a book slightly larger than most tradition books as opposed to monstrously large. The opening, just in case you are worried that Revised destroyed the Society of Aether you know and love, and I recognize that this is a Revised book and they say Sons of Aether throughout, I reflexively say Society of Aether at this point in the same way that I just kind of say Akashiyana. So mentally, Control-C, Control-V, if you're like, well, that's not what it's called, Mr. Robinson. And the opening is entitled Overture, Waves Within. And as a Mage fan, I was rocked that someone had the arrogance to not call it Prelude. And I'm like, this better be entertaining and interesting. But at the same time, I was soothed by the presence of graph paper, which is the sign of the Society of Aether to me. It opens in Southern California in 1978 and goes through the process of what we will later find out is a not quite yet awakened Aetherite being involved in some sort of drag race that involves a souped-up hypercar that uses something called a toroid field that not only do they wind up winning the race, they wind up launching themselves off of a plateau into the atmosphere and starting to come down near Florida. And that is the end of the overture. Did you have any thoughts on that little snippet of opening fiction?
As I was reading it, I could tell this is the beginning of a larger story. So it's like, yeah, where's the rest of it?
So Introduction, Strangeness and Utopia is our standard Revised tradition book introduction. And it says that the Society of Aether is a challenge laid down to the technocracy that their attempts to limit reality will always fail. The theme is the saving power of the impossible, that sleepers will be the victims of magic if they view themselves as powerless to change the universe, and that the technocracy in the 21st century kind of has cross purposes. It can move to secure power by making the consensus feel weak, or it can protect humanity by guiding the masses. Aetherite science is more powerful and could ennoble the masses, or it could destroy them. So it is interesting that much of this book is kind of set up in contrast to the technocracy. A lot of books talk about a tradition in contrast to other traditions. This book was interesting to me because it is in contrast to a different faction in the Ascension War. The mood is realizing science's potential. It mentions that aether science is hard and that its flowering needs to take two forms. One, that new members need to escape infighting and dogma if they are to revitalize the tradition, and they need to make new inventions that they can find ways to share with sleepers if they're going to deal with the problems of the 21st century. This book is also interesting in that it is one of the earliest books to suggest that maybe the technocracy isn't the only big bad guy that humanity has to deal with, and that there could be other things at the time. It could have been international terrorism or climate change or oncoming digital technologies that humanity is going to need to deal with. And maybe total technocratic control may not be up for that. The last part of this section is the vocabulary. And I thought this was interesting because we're going to have an early mention of Terry's Pedantry Corner, in that it uses the term emeritus to indicate that someone is an archmage. Later on, Alexis Hastings is listed as a professor emeritus. Professor usually means adept, and emeritus usually means archmage. And Alexis Hastings is a character we have seen in a number of books. I think most recently it would have been Guide to the Traditions, or alternatively Book of Worlds. So is Alexis Hastings an archmaster or an adept? I'm kind of fine with either, but I thought that was just a little thing that was kind of at cross purposes. They refer to sorcerers and psychics as specialists, which I thought was a really good term that fit well into the Society of Aether meta paradigm. I feel uncomfortable referring to their paradigm in any unified way. They also introduce the term Parmenidean, which we had talked previously about how the Society of Aether was originally called the Parmenideans until someone helpfully pointed out that their style of magic was completely at odds with the belief in Parmenides, who said that more or less change was impossible. They use it as a term that states all real and unreal things exist in the universe. And a Parmenidean is someone who kind of has that philosophical view. And that is an impressive twisting of what Parmenides said. But this is Mage, so that's kind of par for the course. I thought the lexicon overall was interesting. I think the theme and mood they set out is a useful and valuable one in Revised. Adam, what did you think about the introduction?
Well, in the intro, they muse about true science, but I don't know. It just, the way they introduce it and speak about it, it seems odd to me. It seems like at the same time it's liberating and limiting. One isn't constrained by one right answer and what others can repeat, yet only awakened can pursue this kind of science. If it only works for the discoverer, well, then how useful is it really? Mm-hmm. So I don't know, just interesting idea to me, but I'm ready to move on to chapter one.
Chapter 1, The Eight-Track Method. Band 1, The Stone Flower. We are introduced to Eves Mercure, or Mercurium, who receives a phone call. This is a French semi-aristocrat who has some sort of mechanical assistant who's doing all sorts of research, who gets a call from what it sounds like is a future version of the kid that we met in the introduction to be like, hey, this thing's about to happen. You should go do this thing. So Eves puts on his ether suit and goes out to help him. In band 2, he meets with the kid in Florida in 2003, which is 25 years after the initial thing is set, walks the kid through some basics of science and awakened science, and then we move on to band 2, The Eternal Caravan of Reincarnation, where the character goes in their souped-up hypercar that has the ability to cross dimensions, leaves this earthly realm and winds up in the Hollow Earth. They meet the Goro monks that are purported to study the lost science of Atlantis, and that Eve's claim is the spiritual birthplace of the tradition. Interestingly, this discussion of Atlantis representing kind of a perfected world that humanity is fallen from, this is 2 years before Mage the Awakening comes out, which very heavily leaned on those themes. Bill Bridges, in a conversation with co-host Josh Heath for Werewolf the Podcast, talked about how Atlantis in Mage the Awakening was originally supposed to be kind of a framing device, more so than anything else, that they ultimately wanted to exclude, and that they wanted to remove any mentions of it in the final pass, and they just never did. The fact that Bill Bridges was the developer for the Society of Aether book that has heavy mention of Atlantis and so on, and that comes out 2 years before Mage the Awakening, I found that connection to be interesting. The loss of Atlantis is presented as happening for one of a number of reasons. One is a traditional story of hubris, another is a story of disaster of some sort, and another is the idea that Atlantis sacrificed itself to stop a greater threat. One of the options they present is that Mirzaba, the comet that we know as Antihelios, is got close enough to the Earth to destabilize the gravity of the planet, sinking the missing continent, but the Atlanteans were able to deflect the comet, and that this mega comet comes back periodically, almost seeking the development of advanced society and trying to crush them, which I like the idea of there being a malevolent mega comet out there somewhere. That seems real mage to me. In the sinking of Atlantis, a lot of the wisdom was lost, and then we start tracking the history of the society through normal human history, that Lorenzo Golo and Simon de Laurent discover that they have two parts of Aretas' Kitab al-Asir, and they form the Natural Philosophers Guild during the Middle Ages. There is a early fight between the Natural Philosophers Guild and the Order of Reason in that they kind of differ in how they think discovery should take place. The Order of Reason thought logic should win, and those who thought the impossible needed more weight were cast out of the organization. This is an interesting idea, except for the fact that the Electrodyne engineers then go on to exist in the organization for another 5 centuries, but eh. Eves continues the tour of possible other realities and presents the Gernsback Continuum as a alternate timeline rather than it being a realm that was created in the 1980s, as previous books indicate. The Gernsback is this retro pulp, I would almost say ray gun gothic or Googie style. To me, it screams more atomic than necessarily pulp in a lot of cases, but that's just because we have like two depictions of it ever. But Band 3 is the future primitive, where we find ourselves suddenly in the future, the year 2012, where there is some sort of technocratic war that, as mortals discover that Merzaba is approaching, people, to use the technical term, lose their shit. The technocracy is like, mortals are doing a thing. We need to stop them. And the mortals are like, no, you're being stupid. And a technocracy, everyone else war occurs. The traditions appear to be united. We are introduced to a number of characters, which we eventually get stats for, which I kind of like, that the once Merzaba is discovered, that humanity kind of bands together to deal with it. The name Merzaba is purportedly Arabic and means iron hammer, which is to suggest that it is the ultimate challenge that humanity will face. Merzaba is presented as containing its own realms that has a number of fantasy, or what we would traditionally associate with like Tolkien-esque fantasy races on it, and the destruction it wrought as it approach exists well into the Umbra and may not actually destroy the physical Earth. The kid helps save the day, as always happens, and that kind of rounds out Chapter 1. So Chapter 1 is this broad-ranging reflection of where the society has been, as well as a thought about the future that introduces an unusual number of named characters for, I think, a tradition book as of this point.
I was trying to understand the tension that they were trying to portray at the beginning of the story, where Ace, the young kid from 1978, he's in the car and it's about to crash and, you know, be a catastrophe, but it's frozen by I guess Eves is how you pronounce the French name, the sophisticated scientific guy.
Yeah. we should call him that.
I don't know. My knowledge of French culture is not as good as it should be, but I was having a hard time understanding that because, one, Eves doesn't know that the guy in the car designed and built the car. I mean, how is he supposed to know that? I mean, he's driving the car, yeah, but maybe he's somebody's driver, so, or a hired, skilled test driver. I don't know. He has no way of knowing that. He just assumes, and of course the story moves on like, yeah, anybody would assume that. Well, anyone except me. Also, Ace is supposed to be terrified that his life is going to end any second, even though the car is frozen and he's having a nice, long, leisurely conversation with Eves. It's like, well, obviously the crash has been stopped. I mean, isn't it time to sort of, you know, relax and say, oh, well, thank you for saving my life. I was worried I was going to crash, but I can see now that I'm not going to crash. So why don't I just open the door and step out and we'll have tea or something like that. But yeah, so they were constantly referring to the tension of Ace saying, I'm going to die any second. And I was reading it saying, no, you're not going to die any second. In fact, you're doing just fine. So a little weird for me, but
you're going to die in 1 second, but we have arbitrary control over time. So like it's...
Yeah, so it's like, in fact, I'll hop into the car with you, exactly. And we're not going to crash. I mean, it's that relaxed. It's like, I'm sorry, the tension is just drained out of this scene.
Yeah.
But so it's a little odd for me, but perhaps I'm just being too picky. Moving on to chapter 25, when we're really talking about the history of things, I was unhappy about this idea that the technocracy turned against the Sons of Aether and their theories because they wanted to prevent the masses from getting free or very cheap energy. I can see how these economic factors and, you know, shadow politics can be interesting for a lot of people. Unfortunately, it wasn't so interesting for me. I gotta say, I like the older idea that the technocracy turned on the Sons of Aether because they wanted to have control of ideas and knowledge and science, really. I liked that high-level abstract wrestling over the importance of abstract academic ideas that somehow that kind of fit the vibe that I appreciate in Mage. People who are so knowledgeable and so abstract in their thinking that they get real hot under the collar over minor academic ideas and go to war over it, whereas this was much more practical economic. It's about, you know, making money and profits and stuff like that. So that was my reaction on that. I really liked this idea of linking Atlantis to Lemuria and through a pre-human culture to Mu, and saying, no, it wasn't aliens that landed. It was just really weird things that used to live here that we just don't know anything about now. I thought that was, it was just a fun idea to play with. And they continued to refer to it throughout the book. For me, that had a real Lovecraft vibe. Specifically, Lovecraft wrote a story, if I'm remembering the title correctly, The Shadow Out of Time, where a human runs across some weird technology and he links into memories of the very, very different, distant past, where he links and kind of mind melds with these very unhuman creatures that started on Earth, had a whole civilization, and then died out and left some relics behind. And so I just thought that was a lot of fun to, as an idea to play with. This fictional account, which is the prelude, although I know it's not called a prelude, and chapter one and the epilogue, it's supposed to be this long narrative that is supposed to teach us history, but I wasn't really happy with it because there was a lot of the story that was not teaching us anything about Mage or the Sons of Aether. It was just contained in its own narrative. And so I would say, you know, if this is a good story, then let it stand on its own as a separate fiction piece. If it's here to teach me about Mage, then it should stick to the subject. So if I want to reference the history of the Sons of Aether as a storyteller a couple months down the road, I'm not going to turn to chapter one of this book. I'm going to go to an older book because it's just more straight and laid out for me with subheaders and stuff, so I can grab what I want and prep for my game. So those are my thoughts on chapter one.
So chapter two is entitled The Essence of Science, and it opens on the last issue of Paradigma from the future. The Paradigma offices in Paris were destroyed in 2000, which I don't recall having been mentioned otherwise.
I'm with you.
Otherwise, it starts through a tradition book that we are now more used to seeing. Mind you, we are now 36 pages in. But it talks about what it refers to as the Wonder Makers, that recruitment for the Society of Aether was formerly a gentleman's club that became less formal after they were ejected from the technocracy. And Victorian Mage actually goes along this at length, as of groups, the Society of Aether, then the Electrodyne Engineers, was one of the more, we pick the white bread and upper crust more so than anything else. The Great Depression made it so that their requirement that you basically needed to have like a PhD and PhDs before you could join was kind of dropped. And there is still a clear divide in the organization between those who joined out of sheer personal brilliance and ingenuity and those who came upon the radar of the organization through their academic background. They mentioned that this is a group that they want you to be exceptional in something, but you need to be well-rounded. There just isn't enough people to allow you to hyper-specialize in anything. There's so much science with a capital S, the term they use recurringly for enlightened or awakened magic, that there, you can't just do one thing. They also introduce an idea that I like, or kind of bring back an idea that awakenings can be slow, that it may be a slow process of realization over a number of weeks and possibly even years that could occur as a character is at some point in their pre-joining period presented with a copy of the Kitab al-Asir, kind of the main text of the Society of Aether. And as they work through its text and implications, that they may awaken, and it may not be a single spontaneous moment as is often presented in most other books. And I think there is certainly enough space in Mage for there to be multiple types of awakening. The character, once they've consumed the text, are asked to do some sort of novel research, and that they will do some sort of thesis defense where they need to present an idea and have it defended against the onslaught of a number number of Aetherite members and kind of prove their mettle. Previously, they mind-wiped failed students, that those who didn't ultimately awaken after they had been exposed to the society were kind of kicked out. And one of the things that this book does is, unlike the one ebook that was almost entirely epistolary in terms of presentation of certain topics, where it was just letters from Aetherites to Paradigma, this is kind of a mix of it, of this omniscient narrator plus these little excerpts that are dropped in. And there's one on this, on whether or not does it make sense to mind wipe students. And I just picture the Society of Aether being like, we're the Society of Aether. If a student fails, sometimes we ask them to forget things. And like next to them is an Ollie Bateen master that just says like, hold my beer. Or something like that. new members become initiates, which are referred to as researchers. On reaching adept, you can get sponsorship and can become theoretically a professor. You can ask for assistance from researchers, and you would publish in an academic journal, but they mentioned that Paradigma has split into a number of journals, and instead, one of the ways of sharing what you've come up with are at regular symposia, where Aetherites get together and share their inventions. Above the researchers, there is the role of chairs. There are a finite number of these. We get 6 that are listed. You need to at least be a master to do this, and it is reasonably prestigious to do so. Borders between what areas are covered is kind of fuzzy. One of the interesting powers given to a chair is that they can ban research. And one of the things that pops up throughout this book is the idea of scientific ethics, which I think is an interesting focus to bring into the group. The Order of Hermes has the Codex Hermeticus or whatever it is, and the Society of Aether also has their own research guidelines. The next section goes over ethics, where the Ethics Council, or the Council for the Enforcement of Scientific Ethics, can be convened to investigate a failure of ethics. Each convened group includes between 3 and 6 members. A third are defendants, and they require a 2/3 majority to enact a sentence. There are options to get a retrial if you think something's wrong. Interestingly, if you are accused of being a traitor or infernalism, there is a lower standard of evidence before you are kicked out or receive punishment. Mind is often used to investigate and to get evidence. They don't quite understand Gil-Ghul, which they mention is both a practical thing, because they're like, getting a qualified soul render is really hard. So we're like, let's just kill the guy. I just like the idea. Anytime like death is the compromise, that kind of tells you the stakes. They also have a flavorful aside called Disputed Claims, which talks about how Tsar Vargo's conversion engine, the evidence for it ever having existing, seems to be dropping over time, which they kind of all agree is some sort of paradox manifestation. And they just kind of add to their record that they're like, yeah, this guy invented this thing. And it's interesting because it's one of the few cases in Mage where paradox is kind of presented as cleaning up after the mage. You have werewolf with delirium, and you have wraith with the veil, and you have changeling's mists. I wish at some point we got information on paradox kind of hiding magic in a more formalized form than we've gotten so far. The next section is called Learned Societies, which talks about the groups within the Society of Aether. Adam, can you tell us about those?
I'd be happy to. We have 3 formal groups, 3 informal groups, and 3 small unofficial groups. First off, we have the Royal Aethernautical Society is dedicated to exploring aetherspace. They received a royal charter in 1851 to explore the heavens, which is why royal is in their name. After the Avatar Storm, they turned to exploring remote areas of Earth and regular space, although there are still occasional journeys into aetherspace. The Society has 3 divisions. Propulsion Science creates systems for exploration craft and researches how to explore further. Material Sciences discovers new materials to help all areas of exploration. Human Sciences prepares aethernauts for exploration. We have the Cybernetic Research Institute, which started in 1910 as a reaction to the technocracy's innovation, the assembly line. They focused on mechanical control systems and developed robots and other inventions that they had trouble getting into sleeper society. In 1961, the virtual adepts joined the Council of Nine. They inspired the Institute to work with them on information networks and similar projects. The Great Whiteout, where the digital web crashed in 1997, caused Institute members to work more on their own. Their 3 divisions have whimsical names. Brains focuses on machine control systems and computer-related inventions. Brawn creates vehicles, robots, and exosuits from a variety of techniques. Blam extend power, endurance, and firepower of different machines. They gather quarterly and suffer from such chronic underfunding that members sometimes turn to shady methods for the resources that they need. The Utopian League started out as scientists deeply concerned with the technocracy's decision to withhold helpful discoveries from society. They became the lawgivers and judges of the Sons of Aether. They also disseminate helpful scientific theories into the consensus, that is, sleepers, masses. They don't focus on any particular area of science, but have an interest in non-lethal weapons. Now, for the three informal groups, adventurers don't spend a lot of time in the lab because they're out where adventure calls and danger threatens. They have dealt with several problems over the years for the tradition, so there are those willing to overlook the informal, pragmatic methods the adventurers use, as well as the scarcity of published discoveries. They often work alone, but can cooperate when the need is great. They are known for taking buried secrets and ancient superstitions and turning them into working inventions or techniques. The dissidents, or mad scientists, became recognized in 1919 when one sent a letter to Parademia objecting to the Ethics Council of the Utopians. They are a mix of individuals who want to pursue their own obsessions without regard for consequences, and scientists who want to be free from the Utopians. They have no particular fields they focus on as a group. After the Avatar Storm, they have started to collect in groups. Progressivists are leftist scientists who focus on politics rather than science. They work to overturn injustices and inequalities in the tradition. Although their notions existed in the tradition from the earliest days, it was in 1935 when Parademia published an issue calling attention to injustices in published research that they became a coherent group. Many are active in sleeper politics. And now we have the three smaller and unofficial groups. Some of these are just cabals. The Scroll of Destiny is a cabal that defeated Nefandi, who were using long-lost Egyptian secrets. Afterward, one of their own members stole the Ennead effigies. They now pursue their rogue member, as well as investigate the many secrets they uncovered during their struggle. The Manhattans are a group of men who dress like the 1950s and believe weapons are liberating and lead to a better world. They create weapons of mass destruction they distribute liberally, as well as info on how to make more. The Hastings Fellowship is a progressivist group that combats discrimination, funds disadvantaged scientists, and correct misattributed scientific work. So those are our nine factions.
And then we go on to what is called the Book of Aether, which talks about the Kitab al-Asir, the text that is frequently discussed but rarely revealed. It starts with a discussion of how the book has great antiquity and how it probably wasn't smuggled out of Troy and how certain parts of it are probably just an allegory and it's probably not quite as old as people say, but there are differences between versions that kind of help reveal things. And this is where it gets into an attempted justification of the philosophical underpinnings of the society. And this is the part where I kind of just braced and went, sure? It makes the claim that only real things can be described, and so all describable things must exist. But the problem with this is that we only let a small amount of what is possible to be true. That when a claim and its opposite arrives, we need to reconcile them in some way or reject them both. Otherwise, to not would be illogical. And it represents this idea of what we allow to exist as the walls of the city of Troy, that the universe is full of propositions that we may or may not believe are true, and that our goal is to continually expand the wall as new ideas come against it. Otherwise, we will not be able to hold it back. The walls will be crushed and the universe will kind of consume us. That ideas require a medium, and that medium is the ether, and the ether contains all things that have not yet been perceived. We must embrace these enigmas and the laws that they imply, and that also the aetherite needs to go beyond the walls of the city of their own Troy and bring back things rather than simply wait. It then makes the claim that everything is real, but not everything is true, and that when we make the real true, that's science. I literally have no idea what that sentence means. It is very important. Maybe that's the best made sentence of all time, but I'm just like, what? That's the explanation of the Kitab. The next section is entitled Chaos Science, that claims the methods of etheric science is non-reductive, and this is time 7 of 214, where the book yells at the technocracy for being reductionist. Like, they say it like it's a bad word. Like it's like someone saying like, well, you're an empiricist, and trying to use that like it's a slur or something like that. And I'm like, I don't get it. One of the few things that unites them, besides this idea that contemporary science doesn't contain all possible truth, which I don't think anyone would argue with, is that the ether exists as a medium of something, and the phenomenon of quintessence is just one emanation of the ether. That other ethers could exist that contain partially formed things. Okay, not sure what that means, but that's an idea. That on one end of discovery, you have the myth scientists, and on the other end, you have the technocracy, and in the middle, you have the parapsychologists and investigators of Fortean phenomenon. Fortean, an adjective named after Charles Fort, who wrote a book called The Book of the Damned, which was short for The Book of This Damned Data, which just collects a whole bunch of weird occurrences. They try and mine other paradigms for science, and they give us the standard example of being like, oh, the Akashiana member who can walk on walls is just well-trained in certain breathing activities that allow them to adjust the musculature of their feet to do blah-de-blah. That is a long-standing trend in Mage, that they investigate weird phenomenon, and that a lot of the phenomena they investigate, though, are not other night folk, which I appreciated. It's like, we don't spend a huge amount of time with vampires, but there's all these other weird things that we may want to investigate. It talks about technology of ancient times that may also be a source, that they go through discarded technologies, and they like to investigate the semi-scientific occultism of like Victorian spiritualism or theosophy, strange yogic practices. They focus a lot on materials that have properties that other elements don't. In the strange genius section, we get a number of merits. Mad science is an interesting one in that it literally makes magic easier during quiet. What does that mean? Like, we never really got fully fleshed out rules on what quiet looks like or how to act during it. So that seemed like an odd one. Then there's also the scientific mystic merit where you get an extra focus. Okay. If revised uses an individual paradigm, why would you need a merit for that? You could just say that's what your character does from the start. I think that fits perfectly already into the rules we have without requiring a merit for it. It then goes through the spheres, and it rattles off a bunch of sciences that could be used as a justification. My favorite is where it says, forces, a common focus is ray guns. It's stereotypical, but they work. Okay. Matter tends to be innocuous, that they tend to work with traditional tools there, and normal lathe, saws, and screwdrivers perform with superior precision in etherite hands, which I liked, and that garages and kitchens have all the scientific tools that a etherite needs for matter science. I kind of like the idea that a specialty sphere represents the fact that you can do more than other people with the same tools, rather than having access to more advanced tools, but that's something we never really get rules on, and it's just kind of an idea that is brought up. We get a number of devices, or wonders in this case. One is a death ray, which this is one of those cases where it's an interesting idea, but mechanically it doesn't quite work out. It talks about how you get to roll your arete for it, since it's not a talisman. In exchange for subtracting 4 successes, you can put it into fully automatic mode, which would give it the fully automatic trait that exists for some guns, which gives you additional damage dice. But considering this is a forces effect, that would almost never make sense. We get a rote to create premium, and the answer is it's hard. So that is a matter 5 prime 3 effect. Premium is the anti-magic material that is also quite potent. It is noted for being the cladding of hit marks. The rules on a orgone accumulator allow you to accumulate resonance traits, which I thought was kind of interesting. And we also get the idea of quantum temporal travel. We have not yet, I think, been introduced to the idea of Everett volumes, which is to say alternate universes are alternatively the mirror zones, if you consider those to be the same thing. But it requires correspondence 3 or 4, entropy 4, or time 3 or 5, which it mentions that at the lower level, for each success, you get to go back a turn. Considering the difficulties involved, it's one of those cases where, like, the ritual to do this might take you several hours to then go back one turn. Seems kind of pointless. We also get the idea of recommendations on modifying sorceress paths to work with a Society of Ether specialist, which is very similar to what we get as the idea of, like, use science or technology instead of a cult. Okay, got it. And it recommends some paths like alchemy, conveyance, enchantment, and hellfire, as well as any of the psychic phenomena that are listed. We get some inventions. Also introduced the idea of wonder spheres. This is a system by which a character can buy a sphere at half off if it is only going to be used to create charms, talismans, and artifacts. You can then buy it up to a regular sphere level at a little bit more than half cost. And it also introduces the Kitab as a wonder or a primer that can cause awakening. It also mentions that this is a book that there are other versions of it floating around that mages have added to that may allow you to do more than just awaken, that someone may have added marginalia or additional content that could teach you a sphere or something like that. And the idea of there being versions of a grimoire, I thought, was an interesting idea. That was a lot of magic. Adam, what did you think about this chapter?
First off, at the beginning of chapter two, it was very interesting for me, like you said, to find out that Parademia magazine stopped when the Avatar Storm started. And it's like, we're in late 2003, Mage Revised Edition is almost done, and we find out that the signature magazine that is always mentioned along with the Sons of Aether ain't there. It's like, well, couldn't you have told me that, you know, towards the beginning of Revised Edition? It would have been kind of nice. Talking about the ranks of Aetherite science, the top two, the chairs, which are basically masters, and the emeriti, which are basically archmasters, the material there lines up very well with the book Masters of the Art, which is technically a second edition book, but it was after Brocato left, and I really think of it as a revised edition book. So it was interesting to see that the authors of this book were paying very close attention to that and wanted to work its material in, which I guess is appropriate for revised edition. There's a sidebar called Pulp Culture, and it mentions that, yeah, pulp culture has an influence on Aetherites, but usually it's the young ones that get excited about it, and as they get older and more mature, they start toning it down. And I just disagree. I think the pulp culture influences are awesome, and I would love to see some 55-year-old scientist going, yeah, I love this stuff. So I don't think it's necessarily anything to be ashamed of, but I'm kind of an oddball, so don't listen to me. Page 48 was a page on the adventurers, which used to be called Pulp Heroes, and in the first edition book. And I really liked the explanation they gave to their approach to science. I thought it was appropriate, and it would be something that I would hand to players who would want to play that kind of Aetherite scientist. The basic idea here is, in the old pulp stories, there is this. There are many examples of ancient devices that do amazing things. The stories have the notion that the ancients discovered a technology long ago, but viewed it through a religious or mystic framework. In the eras that came after that, the rest of the world, the other cultures of the world, just assumed it was impossible, so they never tried to develop it. And so a lot of published real-world pulp stories run with this idea, and that does make them nice inspiration for mage games that involve Sons of Aether. So it was nice how page 48 really kind of broke it down for us and helped us to see that. The faction called Scroll of Destiny, it's really sort of a cabal that is willing to take on new members. You know, the hint is if your players want to join this or even be this group, they could. I thought that was just really cool. It was basically adventurers who went out, they discovered the Nafandi were running around with ancient Egyptian secrets, and they busted that Nafandi group, but in the process, they opened up a can of worms. There's all these things they discovered. One of their members went rogue, and so now there's all this stuff going on in the shadows connected with ancient Egyptian magic and modern Aetherite inventions. And so I thought that was a lot of fun to put into the book and play with. This chapter mentions the optical quantum computers, which are not at all the same thing as the trinary computers that the virtual adepts use. And again, I thought that was very interesting. That's something I would like to play with if I had any kind of chronicle that involved techno magic and the details of it. I liked to see the section on the Aetherite labs. I thought that was helpful and appropriate. It's like, here are these factions that we just mentioned to you. Well, here's their labs. Here's where they are. Here's what they're doing there. Here's what you might find if you walked in. I thought that was very appropriate for this book, and I'm very glad that they thought of that. When we get into the explanations of theory and the underpinning ideas of this tradition, there was the Walls of Troy metaphor that they mention. I thought this was interesting, saying basically the walls of the city, Troy in this case. Inside the walls is everything we know and understand and is a part of our life and we talk about. And outside of the walls is basically the unknown. And so the idea is to recognize which side of the wall is this idea on. And gradually the ideal goal is to work towards expanding out those walls so that there's more you are comfortable with and understand and less that is frightening and unknown and that you are ignorant of. So I thought it was an interesting metaphor. I thought it was rather clever, but in my own games, I'm going to fall back on the Paraphysis by Parmenides and the Commentary by Alan Randall, which was a part of Honor's Mage Page back in the day, and I've pulled into the new Honor's Mage Page 2.0. I really like that explanation of things. I think it's very nice to link it to players that are going to be in some of my games. It's not very long. It's packed with interesting ideas, and I would actually use that more than the Walls of Troy metaphor myself. I don't like the idea of idealizing ether, saying that ether is more of a concept and you can express it so many different ways. I like it as an actual physical substance that the Sons of Ether actually discovered. To give you an example, in first edition, the ether goggles that Sons of Ether used, they were goggles that had ether in them, and because of that, they could do things that normal goggles couldn't do. In revised edition, ether goggles are just goggles that are made by etherite scientists, and there's no actual ether in them, because ether's more of an idea. I just think it's fun as a physical substance that normal science tells you isn't there, but etherites say, no, it's there, we use it. The foci section in this book I thought was very good. It basically said, here, let's look at tools that etherites use, whether they are common tools in uncommon ways or concepts or ideas or odd inventions. I thought this was very helpful, very appropriate. I get disappointed by the foci sections in some books. It's kind of like something they tacked on at the last minute. But in this book, they thought it through well. They gave it some good space, and I think it's helpful to pass to players. We get merits and flaws. I think they were forgettable. I would not use them in my games. The rotes section, there's a lot of very interesting rotes here. It makes it really worth a look, even if you're not running with revised edition rule set. The antimatter rules I thought were very interesting. How to make it, how much damage it does, what quantity that has what effect. I thought that was very nice. Creating primium was useful to have there. I thought it was too strict. You need to have very high sphere levels, and you need to have a whole lot of resources. In fact, if you don't have these dots of resources on your character sheet, then guess what? You can't make any. And I thought that was just a little too strict. I would lighten it up a little bit. I thought it was very interesting to see the quantum temporal travel section. We have mentioned in recent episodes that towards the end of revised edition, the developer Bill Bridges wanted to kind of loosen up the Umbra a little bit, make it easier for people to get there. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, this is a workaround to get around the Avatar Storm to get to the Mirror Zone, which was mentioned back in second edition Mage. It's basically the alternate universes spot. You can go to alternate Earth and see where, you know, some things are the same and some things are totally different. A lot of people like to play with those ideas. And as I was reading through the section, when I got to the end, it said Mirror Zone. I'm like, yeah, I know. You didn't need to tell me, but okay, we're on the same page with this one. So that was fun. Page 65 gives us rules for giving technomancers advantage when making wonders. I thought that was kind of handy. It should have been in the Forged by Dragon's Fire, which is the book all about wonders and making them. It would have been much more appropriate there, but I kind of get this feeling that the people working on this book had just finished reading Forged by Dragon's Fire, and they're like, no, we think technomagical devices should be a little easier to produce for technomages, so we're going to put this in here. And also, page 65 also has the Wonder Spheres, which are basically you can spend less experience to learn a level in a sphere, but only for making wonders, not for anything else. I thought it was a nice idea, but it can be rather complicated to apply it the way they describe it. I've got a wonder sphere, but it's not a regular sphere, but I want to spend the experience to like expand it into a regular sphere so I can do this anywhere I go. And I don't know, the rules can get pretty complicated pretty quickly, so I would want to do a very careful consideration before pulling that into my games. But it's nice to have these kind of alternate ideas to play with and to suggest for us, even if we don't use them exactly as published. So those are my ideas on Chapter 2.
Chapter 3, entitled The Dynamic Faculty, talks about the group itself. We get the character sheet for Chevalier Yves Mercure. I assume that if I just kind of swallow my tongue enough, that should pass muster with most people and pronouncing the French language. He is a quiet person that is also quite charming and likes clocks. Refers to electricity as the child of capriciousness, which I kind of liked. We get Ace, the character from the introductory fiction, and a few other characters, the Discoid Diva and Dr. Orgone, who are introduced in the fiction late in chapter one, also come up. We get Arlene Dietrich, who was a post-World War II baby who defected from the technocracy. And these are interesting in that, like much of Revised, the power level of them is a little bit higher than we got for some of those early characters. And we get some wonderful Lobenstein character studies where each character's nose looks like it is capable of chipping concrete, which is one of the stylistic elements I associate with the Lobenstein brothers. And it's just good to see it in book form. We then get the section of Nothing But Science, which talks about how to run a Society of Aether chronicle, and it talks about the internal struggles may consist of plagiarism and credit, dealing with discovery and the races to find something, promotion to get a new discovery out, and dealing with mad scientists. The dissidents are kind of very much presented as a potential internal antagonist group, in the same way that, like, kind of the Agori are presented as being Cult of Ecstasy members that other Cult of Ecstasy members may not necessarily like, and who need to kind of rein in their excesses. We get mystical antagonists in the form of people kind of questing for nodes, as well as the Aetherites being proud of their ethics by and large, and sometimes clashing with other groups because of their idealism. I thought that was an interesting avenue for storytelling, where a naive or idealistic Aetherite is not used to dealing with the deadly politics of the Euthanatoi or the Order of Hermes or the Akashiana or something, whereas other Aetherites are deadly pragmatic in a way that other groups may find difficult to work with. They present the technocracy as being an antagonist because as a technocracy wants to take the right to experiment from humanity, and that the Society of Aether is partially a funhouse reflection of the technocratic straight man. The idea of a straight man in a comedic routine being one who does not try to necessarily be funny, so you have something to contrast against. And I thought that was a reasonable presentation of comparing a Hitmark to a cybernaut, a roboticist creating some clockwork monstrosity that does something similar versus the mass-produced drones of Iteration X or what have you. We then get the Nazca Saints, which is a Aetherite group where we get character sheets and history and so on. And the Peruvian Nazca lines are presented as possibly being an example of ancient technology. They are these very large structures, that there was a group of scientists investigating it, and that in the process of investigating it, one of the scientists made a bit of a calculation that determined that they should teleport to a particular place to prevent technocrats and government agents to find them. And then they found themselves inside of a essentially massive spaceship hangar that was probably quite old. We get information about what their mission is, that their general goal consists of keeping secrecy regarding their research into what may have been this ancient advanced civilization. They also enjoy clashing with the technocracy and are noted for their debauchery. So it's good that they can still have fun. We then get a sequence of character studies for that group, and then get out of the section courses on etheric study. And this is kind of a tour of weird sciences that are a mix between things that the authors came up with and kind of what was going around as weird science in the early 2000s. They talk about how nodes are an expression of mapping of etheric currents onto the Earth, and that new nodes represent finding minor figures. They also present the idea of progress theory, utopianomy, and eschatonomy, which is the idea that progress occurs at a certain rate that ultimately culminates in catastrophe points, and that they have very precisely calculated that the next catastrophe point will be December 22nd, 2012, when Merzaba hits. Alternatively, it may be a point of mass ascension as humanity joins together to stop it. They do a fair amount of research into missing civilizations like Atlantis, Mu, and Lemuria, in a previous go, the dinosaurs of Lemuria that pushed away the comet may have been responsible, and any options to bring up dinosaurs in Mage, I'm generally in favor of. They also talk about species that may have evolved alongside humanity, and this is the way that they describe vampires and werewolves as parallel interbreeders that have existed alongside civilization for quite some time. Ghosts are the remaining etheric vibrations after a person dies, and it's collection of paradigm elements that you can use if you want to try and explain the rest of the world of darkness within a viewpoint that a etherite may take. We then get the Heralds of Science, which are a collection of character sheets. A lot of these are interesting. That I like the arc of the street parapsychologist, who is a character that was using parapsychology as a way of grifting and making money and then found out that it was real. There's a character called the Mad Bomber and goes around bombing things and was trying to find somebody else who bombed things, and now they make bombs for science. Yeah. We also get the Shadow Ministry agent, which is this Austin Powers-esque character that works for the Shadow Ministry, which is kind of represented as this the secret organization that works alongside the world governments that takes care of questionable elements. I would have liked more information on the Shadow Ministry, but we don't get a huge amount on it. The kind of inverse of the NWO is something that I certainly would have liked more information on. And then finally we get an epiphany that attempts to wrap things up. We get the reflections of the characters that we met in the introductory fiction, as one character laments about wasting their time working on cars, and then we get a few references. And that kind of brings us to the end. Did you have any thoughts on Chapter 3 and the epilogue?
Arlene Dietrich hates people and has no close relationships. She's also on the Shadow Ministry. If you have a problem with that, you can take it to the Ethics Council, who are also utopians. Good luck with that. The Sample Cabal is interesting. I did like the ideas behind that, much better than Sample Cabals from other revised edition trad books, but the partying was too far out for me. It's like, okay, here's a group doing important stuff. They really need security. They have secrets to keep. And they throw wild parties and invite everybody. It's like, I just can't see that one working out in the end. I think it was in this chapter, they had the idea of the Etherites fragmenting. For example, there is no Parademia magazine anymore. There's lots of different scientific journals of varying quality and varying agendas. This idea that Terry and I discussed in the past, that after the Avatar storm and the dramatic shakeup to Mage society that it was, it seems like a couple of years afterwards, a lot of the known Mage factions, be they technocrats, crafts, traditions, whatever, could well break up and come apart. And so this book does seem to hold that idea in it of not only Parademia magazine, but the different factions of Etherites that have been around for years seem to be going in different directions in this book. The Courses of Etheric Study takes the place of legends in this revised edition trad book, and I thought that was appropriate because Etherites, of course, are not going to be trading around myths and legends so much. They're going to be talking about what they're working on and what it means. I like the idea of combining fields in pairs. This section is also a nice way to suggest specialties for player characters, and I think it works well for that. I think mages would blur the boundaries between fields of study as they get into enlightened science, or what we would call sphere magic. So I thought this section fit well. It was fun to read. I enjoyed the idea of the new words. Instead of saying geology, they would say geonomy, and the idea behind that is... ology seems to imply compiling data on a subject, whereas onomy seems to imply more properly naming it or naming something that had no name before. And so even though a lot of us would see that as wordplay, I think it was fun, and I think it's something nice for players to work with. Making up funny, vaguely scientific-sounding names somehow seems appropriate for an Etherite Chronicle. Yeah. I could go with that. Specifically, the section on bionomy and psychonomy has a very nice concept of will-working, true science, or sphere magic, that is rooted in a material world. And I'm not going to go into all the details there. You can read it for yourself. But I just really liked that. It seemed to be very appropriate for a mage book. It's like Etherite sort of kind of fumbling and groping towards an understanding of mystical and transcendent things, but somehow rooted in materialistic scientific research. I just thought it fit. The Two-Fisted Socialist was way too obvious for me. It was just sort of in your face. And the Street Parapsychologist, it was an interesting idea for a character, but honestly, it really didn't seem like an Ethrite. I couldn't see the Ethrite approach to life or science or really anything in there. It just sort of seemed to be a mage that hangs around with the Ethrites, but really never soaked up their thinking or their culture. So that was kind of weird for me. We get a second shadow ministry agent in this chapter. This one is told to be selfish and egotistical. What a nice bunch. We're told in the book that the shadow ministry is doing great and good things, but every time we see one, they're a rotten egg. I wonder how that works. When I hear a name, shadow ministry, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is, Alex, I'd like to buy a clue for $100. They call themselves the shadow ministry? Are they really going to be that nice a group? It's like, maybe we should put two and two together here? That's my thoughts on chapter 3 and the epilogue. So I guess at this point we can start drifting into to general ideas. Terry, what were your ideas on the book as a whole?
Well, I have a question for you. One of the things that this book kind of mentions a good bit is it presents time travel as being real and doable, and it doesn't result in everyone exploding in a cloud of paradox. We get the rote about exploring alternate histories, that may be the cause. In the epilogue, we are told that it could be an epiphany that is being used to navigate through things, and there is an argument between Eves and Ace about, like, did you waste my time? And Eves like, it was an adventure or something like that. How do you feel about this end-of-the-world narrative being so strongly presented? If I were reading books at the time and I didn't know that Ascension were coming, I don't know how I'd feel about it. Like, I never got the feeling of having this book, reading it, and not knowing how much more mage there was. I only got Society of Aether Revised after I already knew that the line had ended, if that makes sense. Like, I knew the end was near.
Yeah, I was abroad and hitting small RPG games stores in UK and scooping up my mage books and basically shipping them home because I didn't have room in my luggage. But I couldn't stop buying books. And so, yeah, this was my first time reading this book, so I can't give you the perspective of someone who read it right when it was fresh and it just came out. I grabbed it like a couple of months late in London and shipped it home.
Got it.
to read for this podcast, as it turns out. The impression I got was I was thinking of Infinite Tapestry, which you and I read just recently. And I think if I was a person reading it at the time, I would connect that in with the Infinite Tapestry chapter on the High Umbra talking about Epiphemies, and I cannot remember the name of it right now.
The Apex of Mystery?
Yeah, there's one Epiphany, which is basically viewing the end of the world, and it was kind of this awkward write-up of how you're going to play through a chronicle in very compressed time for your players about how the world ends, and then when it's over, your players will have some inspiration about living and how the world is, and they'll take that home with them as a moral lesson or something like that. And so, yeah, when I read this fiction here in Sons of Aether Tradition Book Revised about how Mirzaba's coming, we've got to fix it all, okay, now let's take the main character and shove him back to 1978 so he can get back to his regular life, I was thinking of that. It seemed to be like grabbing that and saying, hey, how would this play out? What would it look like? Here we go. Here's an example. Reading it, you know, this past week, I see it as, we're getting close to 2004, where Mage Revised Edition ends, and there's not even many books in 2004, and so it's like, yeah, I think all the writers working on Mage in late 2003, they're all getting excited about the big finish, and they brought it in here.
Well, listener, if you have experience of what it was like to grab this book when it was hot off the presses and see the end of everything, drop us a note. I am curious what your thoughts were. But otherwise, this book felt messy to me in two senses of the word. One, the large chunk of fiction After we had gotten so many tradition books, especially those with the with Malcolm Shepard's name on it, that were dense with useful stuff, to then get something that had so much word count dedicated to the fiction, I kind of viewed as a step back. To me, I'm not going to say the revised High Watermark was quite Order of Hermes, but the authors of that book, there was no in-world fiction. Sometimes there were literary flourishes, but it was just stuff from cover to cover. And a group like the Society of Aether, as I think proven in first edition, you can do that. There are new themes and ideas that are presented here. You could have had more pages of fringe science. We could have gotten more rotes or examples of what they do. The Society of Aether is interesting to me in that I don't think they have a paradigm so much as they have a meta paradigm, so that they have a, they believe that all things are true and we kind of need to discover the truth of them, and they have a scientific toolbox to do that. You could interpret it as either being unusually wide in practice and narrow in paradigm, or vice versa, that they have a remarkably wide paradigm and it all goes through the tools and practices of weird science, which is a huge practice in M20 terms. And I think either of those are good presentations. So I was just kind of expecting more. I mean, it doesn't help how good the 1E book is. And it tells you something that Bill Bridges, even now, when in interviews is asked, like, what was the favorite thing that Bill ever worked on, or what he some things that stick out for him, that Society of Aether 1E, Sons of Aether 1E, is mentioned in that, considering the, at this point, millions of words that Bridges has produced. I think it was also messy philosophically. I don't know. Maybe it's one of those things where if you investigate the paradigm of any of the other traditions, or the most common paradigmic elements in other traditions, that anyone familiar with it would likewise say, hey, this is sloppy, or hey, this doesn't make sense. But to me, I don't get a feeling that the authors had a strong sense of what scientific reductionism means.
Yeah, but I agree.
The idea is that a large number of phenomena can be explained using a small number of entities, that notions of things like species are useful because it allows us to treat a large number of organisms and entities with some sort of shared set of features. Now, you can say that there's a kind of excess of reductionism when people have a tendency to get rid of important differences between members of a group. But in certain cases, we quite simply don't care about the elements that make individual things unique. If we do insist on maintaining that uniqueness, that prevents us from drawing any conclusions, and that removes the ability of us to make inferences. And that's kind of the basis of science, that you say these class of phenomena are related based on this experience, this outcome occurred. I believe it is the case that this is generally how the system is going to operate. I think it would have been much more interesting if they took a more Borgian view and said there is a different way to reduce these phenomena, to say, well, these elements that you didn't think have something in common actually very much do. And that allows us to come to different conclusions, to say, hey, this thing is like this, and to come up with different ways of representing science. I would say that the technocracy is not necessarily reductionist, but they are exclusionist, in that they are certain phenomena they don't want to have exist. So they will try to come up with a frame that gets rid of those elements of uniqueness or what have you, to kind of remove it from reality, the quest to remove reality deviance.
Technocrats approach it with assumptions. This mm-hmm. should be neat and clean and make sense to me, and I will force it into that box. And so mm-hmm. coming to it with those assumptions ahead of time changes everything.
Yeah. The notion of science in Mage is a very fraught question. It is a hard question to answer, like, what does discovery mean? And maybe we do an episode about that at one point. But I think the book kind of swung at the ball, and I don't think it connected very well. I was surprised that there was no treatment of marauders, really. We got a few references to Nafandi. We got a few references to Sorcerer. I don't recall there being an obligatory mention of mummies, so I was a little bit disappointed in that, but I may have just missed it. But I was expecting more on that. I did like how they presented mad scientists as kind of an internal possible enemy, and we got a little more information on how the groups deal with each other. I also don't know if this book was the first one to introduce the idea that we landed on the moon in the 1890s, and the idea that the Society of Aether still has dirt on the technocracy, and one of the reasons they haven't been completely crushed is the implicit threat that says, hey, if you get in the way of what we're doing, we're going to come to the British government and show them that the Queen approved us landing on the moon in the 1890s, which is just a weird sentence to say out loud, which I'm perfectly fine with as a Mage fan. But it brought a lot. It's one of those things where this book had very high expectations. It didn't quite deliver on it. On the whole, I still thought it was a pretty good book. If I were to rewrite it today, I would certainly tighten up some things. Hard time finding things in it. But on the whole, it's a B plus to me. Adam, what did you think about it?
For me, the comparison is kind of hard to make because naturally, when I look at a tradition book revised, I think of the first tradition book, which was in, you know, one of the first two editions of the game. In this case, it's tough for me because the first Sons of Aether book was so wild, so fun, so upbeat. I just loved it. It's like I didn't just read it, I soaked in it. And so with this book, different take on things, different edition of Mage, different way of looking at things. So it naturally, it's going to be different. I mean, one thing that stood out to me was first tradition book was about big imagination, bold characters, new worlds to explore, all kinds of crazy things going on. It's like, it was more than a tradition book. It was like a general purpose supplement for Mage, all these new realms, horizon realms, parts of the Umbra, etc., that became a part of every edition of Mage. A lot of stuff that Mage fans recognize well from any edition of Mage started in that book. And we come to this book now, and there's no new worlds, there's no big imagination stuff, which I realize it's not for everybody, but I liked it. In fact, there's that quote in chapter one about how the physical world is exciting enough for me, always has been, and it should be for everybody. And it's like, yeah, okay, I get that. Okay, we're not getting any crazy new worlds in this book. But I can't help but make the comparison in my mind. I thought it was odd that this book claims all the cool parts of science for the Sons of Aether. For example, dark matter, quantum energy, and possibly one or two others. I can see how this makes the Sons of Aether look cool. But these are parts of mainline science that is discussed in college and high school textbooks even back in 2003. And so when you do that, you're making the Sons of Aether a lot more influential than I think any edition of Mage is trying to make them out to be. They're supposed to be marginalized, shunned, called weirdos by the rest of the scientific community, and yet they're coming up with everything that's going in the high school textbooks. I think we should consider that a little more carefully. One strength of this book is a good explanation of concepts from the Paraphysis by Parmenides, which was more influential in the early parts of Mage, especially the planning stages, than by now in revised edition. But I like how this book actually explained some of those ideas. It got into the weeds, and sometimes I guess it got messy, but for me, there were several helpful parts. The first tradition book made mention to it, but really didn't explain it, really didn't give us much on it. And so in that sense, this book has some strong passages that I really like. Honestly, as a Mage fan and a Sons of Aether fan, this book was a dark take on the Sons of Aether for me. And I realize that not everybody reading this book is going to have that impression. I'm not saying it's the right way to view this book, but it's how I cannot help but view this book. The progressivists, they were in the first tradition book. And they were the antithesis of the traditionalists. The traditionalists are like, you know, everything old we like, and the progressivists are everything new we like. And it's like, okay, fine, everybody's welcome there, and everybody who makes a player character and jumps into that group is free to be progressive in any way that they want. This book says the progressivists are leftists, and in order to join this group, you have to actively work on leftist causes. So if you don't think of yourself as a leftist, we don't want you here. And if you think of yourself as a, you know, some other end of the political pie, and you think of yourself as a progressivist, then you're out of luck with this one. The Utopians used to be these dreamy optimists. Now they run the tradition, and it says in several places that they strictly enforce their will and make examples of anybody who steps out of line. That's a big change from the Utopians of the first two editions. The mad scientists used to be nutty, kind of silly, I mean a little edgy at times. Now they're mass murderers. Now it's like they're killing huge numbers of people, and even the ones who aren't, it specifically states, they agree with the ones who are. It's like, yeah, I'm a mad scientist and I'm not killing tons of people, but I think my two friends, they totally ought to do that. So, wow, that is a really different way to look at this group. It makes it clear that the utopians are running this tradition, and anybody who doesn't like them is going to have to join the dissidents. That's why they're called the dissidents in this edition. But they are specifically vilified. In fact, page 74 says, dissidents are utterly amoral, socially isolated, and calculating. And so as a Mage fan, it's like, well, I can see two ways to interpret this, and I don't know which way is right. First off, the book is just telling me that, yes, dissidents are like this. They are a bad, bad bunch of people. Okay. But then on the other hand, anybody who doesn't like how the utopians are running things is going to go join the dissidents. So is this the propaganda that the dissidents are spreading out to everyone that they claim is true and isn't really true? It's like, yeah, there's really two ways to look at this. And also, it says that people who don't like the utopians are going to join the dissidents. And I have trouble seeing that. I think a lot of Aetherites who don't like what the utopians were doing would just leave the Sons of Aether. They would join the Virtual Adepts or go independent, or even the technocracy. One other thing that makes this a dark book for me is it really looks like the Sons of Aether is about to break up. It says in more than one place in this book that the mad scientists are not only a really bad bunch, but now they're organizing, they're getting together, they're getting bolder and angrier, and they're about to flip the table. And it also says that the utopians are watching the dissidents very closely, and they're planning to clamp down and basically shut them down. Yeah, that's a really different look at this tradition than we have had up to this point. And also, we get this shadow ministry, which is supposed to be like the anti-New World Order. But, okay, I can see how that could be interesting, and you could get a lot of fun out of that. And if you're doing that in your games, hey, you know, sounds like fun. I'd like to play in your games. But honestly, from my point of view as a longtime Mage fan, this is really does look to me like the New World Order successfully infiltrated the Sons of Aether, took it over, and is now running the show. And they are consciously pushing a showdown with the dissidents because one of two things could result, but either way, the New World Order is going to win. One is the dissidents are completely stamped out and utopian rule is established as unquestioned, or the other is the Sons of Aether fragments completely and scatters to the winds, in which case they're no longer a problem for the technocracy. So I have seen mentions to politics and, you know, ideologies and worldviews in the past in Mage books, and it's done in sort of a subtle way. And so it's like, okay, I can see the bias of the authors here, but, you know, they're not pushing it too strongly. So, okay, this is fine. We all have our ideas, and we're free to say what we want. In this book, I think it was too much front and center. For example, the progressivists are only leftists, and we have constant mentions of Soviet-era socialists who left Russia because it's no longer the Soviet era there. So they come to the utopians and the rest of the world. It's like, hey, let's tell you how to run your tradition. And even the members of the utopians who are not, you know, Soviet-era fans, they welcome the people who are and say, hey, let's run this together. And so it's like, if you as a player are picking up this book and saying, well, I'm not really crazy about Soviet-era Russia, you know, then you're not going to like this. But for the other people who do like those things, and I'm not saying it's good or bad, it's just if your point of view is, hey, I think Soviet-era socialism is great, then you're going to read this book and say, well, I think this is great. There's nothing controversial here. We can all agree this is a fun book. It's like, well, I just hope you realize that people who have a different point of view than you are going to look at this book and say, I don't think this book likes me. I don't think I want to play a Son of Aether. I think it was Deirdre Brooks back in the mid-90s who said the test for any splat book, which is like faction book, tradition book, clan book, etc., is after reading this book, do you want to play one as a character? When I read the first Son of Aether tradition book, I didn't really think much of the Sons of Aether. They just didn't loom large in my mind. But after finishing that book, it's like, I got to make a Son of Aether character and play it in a Mage game, because that would be loads of fun. After reading this book, not only do I not want to make a Son of Aether character, I want to hide from them. They're scary now. So, yeah, I'm sorry to bring a wet blanket on this one, but I don't know. That was my impression after reading this.
I think it's really interesting, though, to have that perspective, to be like, hey, this is a dark, menacing way of presenting the Society of Aether. Kind of Wonderland vision of, everything the society does is great and wonderful and will advance humanity, or the utopians will come for you, is like, oh, okay, this is a different way to present things. I may not like it, but okay, I see what's happening. In the same way that, like, I could picture, like, the Euthanatos having a disagreement and be like, it was a polite disagreement. He'll be back in 25 years. And you're like, oh.
I shouldn't be too much of a downer on this. A lot of revised editions said, hey, let's take a mature look at this and question, are the good guys really the good guys and are the bad guys really the bad guys? And this book accomplishes that. So, yeah, I'm not going to say that's bad. I'm not going to say I don't like it. I'm just going to say it's a different way of looking at things, mm-hmm. and it opens up new possibilities. Yeah, when it comes to adventure ideas, after reading this book, one of the first things that came to my mind was, oh, well, how about an adventure idea about how the dissidents and the utopians are moving against each other? But it just seemed so politically charged. It's like, I don't want to introduce any possible controversy into these story ideas for Mage fans. I just want them to be really friendly to everyone. So I steered clear of that stuff. I've got three here that I would like to share with everyone before we move towards the end of our episode. Number one, Dr. Fulminus has developed an optical quantum computer system that has scientists excited. Some say Dr. Fulminus is eager to demonstrate the system's usefulness to take attention away from rumors of a marauder discovered in his lab. Inexpensive to produce, able to send data via cell phone networks, and very fast processing make it popular in laboratories. Its complete incompatibility with normal data protocols make it inconvenient to get started, but totally unhackable by non-optical systems. When a friend of one of the players becomes unstable after using the new computer, the players learn the meta-etherics involved increases the user's most volatile resonance trait to dangerous levels. Can the players convince fellow scientists of the dangers before Dr. Fulminus's mysterious new patron ships demonstration models to Etherite laboratories? Is Fulminus simply misguided, or are the marauders using him? Number two, Ava is a bioroid, a kind of organic android created as the masterwork of a deceased member of Cybernetic Research Institute. Her most fascinating feature is her advanced, self-aware mind that appears to be housed extra-dimensionally. The robotics laboratory where she is studied by Cybernauts announced they have discovered her secret. They can now recreate the complex golden circuitry that lines her hollow skull and are eager to show off her new sisters. Then the robotics lab went silent. Leaders of the Cybernetic Research Institute are asking the players to investigate. They'll be paid a handsome bonus if they resolve the matter quietly. When they arrive at the multi-floor complex, they find a silent building but signs of high power usage. The androids are controlled by Umbrood with their own agenda. Not only that, they've already learned how to use the high-tech toys the Cybernauts were working on in the complex. Can the players rescue the Cybernauts held hostage within? What are the Umbrood really after, and why are they trying to hack into an Iteration X site in the digital web? Number three, the best of friends can cause the worst of problems. An associate of Dr. Gravitas, renowned expert on geology and Earth's energy fields, simply couldn't keep the secret of his latest breakthrough. Several parties outside the Sons of Aether have learned of his new research in realigning gravitic vortices to create a new node anywhere on Earth. His lab was ransacked, where it was learned he's currently continuing his research in caverns beneath Lop Nur, a desert region in West China. The players are asked to travel there to protect Dr. Gravitas. The technocracy would risk much to conceal the doctor's findings. Among all the hurried preparations, the players learn spelunking is a real word, and they're suddenly expected to be proficient in it. Can they find Dr. Gravitas before the technocrats? Can they manage the strange subterranean environment? As if they don't have enough on their hands, the players learn the Wulong Dragon Wizards of China are desperate to keep the cave's secret from outsiders. So those are three ideas I came up with while reading this book. Hopefully you'll come up with some ideas of your own based on those, and write in to magethepodcast@gmail.com and tell us about those. Well, Terry, is there a quote for the end of this book? I'm starting to look really forward to these, I got to admit.
I would first like to commend you on your naming of Aetherite scientists. Dr. Fulminus, that is a quality name. One kind of highlighted the character of Yves Mercure, and it said, and it had Ace going, funny, hey, do you remember that miniature transmission shaft I sketched for you that night? Did you ever try it? How did it work? And Eve replies, oh, that, perfectly. I was a fool to doubt you. In fact, I incorporated it into the device that answered your call. I believe I, and then in quotes, it says, owe you one. As if Eve's saying it, he's kind of throwing up in his mouth a little bit as he's used to reduced to using vulgar argo in this way. The second is just a remarkably magey quote. Adam made mention to the bioroids. The systems for that are presented in the inventions area. Eva has a hollow brain with golden circuitry in it. And the quote regarding this is, "Unfortunately, something has happened to her brain. Storytellers are encouraged to come up with a scenario that suits their own chronicles." Thanks.
Yeah. Guilty.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. One, the line obviously worked. But whenever a mage book is like, just make something up, I'm like, what do you think we've been doing this entire time? those were my thoughts on this.
If you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too, and if you leave a review of Mage the Podcast, it makes us more visible in their searches, and we would certainly appreciate it. You can follow us on Twitter, @MageThePodcast. We're also on the web at MageThePodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there, see the complete show notes that we prepare for you, including any books we may recommend now and then. Terry, can you give us an updated list of our executive producers who we appreciate very greatly?
I would be glad to, and they are
Alexander Gorton, Andrew S., Andrew E., Andy, Berto, Bookers, 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 Brendan Morrill, Bryce Perry, Chris Zack, Dan Svensson, Dennis Osborne, Entropy Prime, Freddy, Gabriel Palazzaro, Gargoyle Noir, Guy Conan Stewart, Ian, Isabel Castillo, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Biggs, Jay Sunsern, Jenna F., John Horton, John Magnuson, Josh Golden, Josh H., Josh Heath, Leslie Weatherstone, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Ralph Scheinhammer, Richard Bat Brewster, Ryan Hilton, Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Stephen Carlton, William Connolly, William Martin, and W. Starter, as well as our remarkably handsome Archmaster backers, Christopher Phillips and Buck Farmer.
So what are we reading next, Adam?
We are going to be looking at The Red Sign, which asks the questions, do vampires and mages go together like peas and carrots? We will find out next time. And until then, truth until paradox, baby.
Go change the world by using mildly racist ideas from the past that we've kind of taken the spit shine off of. But if you research into them, you can still find, watch out for that in Theosophy. But besides that, bye.
I'm so good at podcasting.